Welcome to the Scene Gene Podcast. I'm Ghassan Abouzeneteen from the University of Michigan, Dearborn. The Scene Gene Podcast highlights the voices of contemporary Arab American writers. It is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies and the Arab American National Museum, and funded by the University of Michigan Arts Initiative and the Ford Community Development Fund. Joining us today is Rajia Hasib. Rajia was born and raised in Egypt and moved to the United States when she was 23. Her first novel, In the Language of Miracles, was a New York Times Editor's Choice and received an honorable mention from the Arab American Book Award. Her second novel, A Pure Heart, was one of Literary Hub's best-reviewed books of the week in August of 2019 and one of Real Simple's best books of 2019, among other accolades. She holds an MA in Creative Writing from Marshall University, and she has written for the New York Times Book Review, The New Yorker Online, and Literary Hub. She lives in Charleston, West Virginia. Welcome to Scene Gene, Rajia.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Your novel takes place a few years after the 2011 revolution in Egypt, and it's set both in Egypt and New York City. You primarily focus on the relationship between two Egyptian sisters, Rose and Gamila. Rose, the older sister, is an archaeologist by training. And she's currently working on an exhibit about ancient Egypt at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. She's married to an American journalist named Mark. At the beginning of the novel, we find out that Rose's sister, Gamila, has been killed in a suicide bombing in Cairo. And this news really devastates Rose and her family. Although Rose and Gamila were close growing up, they began to drift apart in adulthood. Can you talk about the tensions that strain the relationship between the sisters? Because I found that through this sibling relationship, we learn a lot about contemporary Egyptian society.
Yes, that was intentional, actually. When I started thinking about the novel, I really wanted to explore the diversity of Egyptian women in themselves as a category, and particularly the diversity of their approaches to things like religion, to things like women's rights and feminism and so on, because I always get the impression that there's an assumption that Muslim women or Arab women are a homogenous entity and they're all the same. So I thought one way to explore this best is to have them be as close as possible, to have them be siblings, and then to have each one represent one possibility of the multiple endless possibilities of characters of Egyptian women. And that's something that I've witnessed in a lot. It's something that I see in my life. A lot of people have asked if this novel is autobiographical. It's not autobiographical, but I do have a sister and we are not alike in many ways. We're very close, but we're very different. And I see that with other friends and so on. So I wanted to explore that particular representation of women when they can be siblings, but they can be very different. And I also wanted to use that to explore what Egypt was going through after the Arab Spring, because the entire society in Egypt had split all of a sudden into two opposing sides. And one side claimed to be more religious than the other side. So we had the religious and the secular, and they were fighting all of a sudden, which hadn't happened before in Egypt. Because of Egypt's history, we didn't have that much room for any political arguments, actually. You know, everything was the same for a very long time. And then suddenly there was a chance that something would change, and all of a sudden you get these different sides, each with a perspective on how things should change and which way they should go to. So I thought the sisters would also represent that split in the entire society well. From then on, it was just kind of gratifying to me to work more deeply on their relationships, just because I really like family relationships and I like intimate relationships between characters in general. It's a more meaty material for me to work with, so to speak. So I started playing with that.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I found that like the family dynamics of Rose's family, it's incredibly intimate. And at the same time, it serves as a microcosm for almost like Egyptian society. So like on that note, Gamila starts to wear the hijab, the headscarf, right? Because you were talking about, you know, that tension between the secular and religion. And so when Gamila starts to wear the hijab, that does cause tensions in her own family. I mean, at one point, Gamita thinks that she feels like an outsider in her own family. And it causes tensions, right, between Gamila and her parents and Gamila and Rose.
Yes, and that's also something that I had witnessed growing up in Egypt, because Egypt as a society up till the 90s, which was less religious than it is now, especially in terms of women covering up. And then all of a sudden, more women started to do it. And then you get these tensions because the older generation, like the generation of the Rose and Gamila's parents, a lot of them rejected the idea of a headscarf, and a lot of them had associated it with a classism, right? It was only peasants covered their heads. Who would want to do this now? But the younger generation that was getting more religious embraced that more. So I saw this tension a lot within families and within even husbands and wives. I know a couple where the wife covered up and the husband left the house for 3 months because he wouldn't, you know, allow it, or he didn't want to allow it. He still ended up realizing that he doesn't have the authority to allow or not allow it, and she still remained covered up. But that tension was something that I saw in the society as well, and that I wanted to explore, partly because it's also interesting, not just in terms of the stereotypes and addressing the stereotypes, but also in terms of the complexity of the characters themselves and the complexity of the issues involving religion and how much it is entangled with classism and with superstition and with a tradition and with so many other issues that direct people's approaches and attitudes toward religion. It's never straightforward. It's not like there's a text that everyone agrees on to the last point and it's just whatever the text says. It's everyone has 100 different opinions about that text, and the opinions are fed by other things such as tradition and superstition and, you know, everything else. So that was another reason I really wanted to go and explore this particular issue.
And something that you said a bit earlier about in writing this novel, you wanted to show like a wide array of what it means to be a woman in Egypt, right? That there's no monolithic image there. There's like a diversity of what it means to be a woman in Egypt. And I wondered, there's a scene, it's like a flashback scene where, you know, Rose is working on an archaeological site in Egypt, and it's when she first encounters Mark, her eventual husband. And there's this really interesting exchange where Rose thinks to herself, I really don't want Mark to think of all Arab women as submissive, right? In a way, I thought that, you know, Rose wanted to kind of go against like the Western stereotypes of Arab and Muslim women. And I wonder, did you have that in your mind? I mean, in writing these characters, were you also writing against like Western stereotypes of the Arab woman as being submissive? And
yes, I was to a certain extent, but I was also writing the attitude toward the stereotypes, because what Rose is also trying to do is embellish things, right? She knows that some of what he's saying is true, but she doesn't want him to know that because we don't air our dirty laundry, right? He's a Westerner. So it was actually fun to play that, because on one hand, yes, I know the stereotypes are often wrong and I know they lack complexity and they're simplistic and I want to represent a more complex idea, but I also find it interesting to explore how people react to these stereotypes. And a lot of times it's just total denial. No, of course, we never have submissive women in Egypt. You know, it's just not even a thing. And I know that's not true either. So it was just fun to play with that. I think at the end of the day, what I was trying to do is just be as honest as possible to present what I see as a plausible version of the truth. There's no capital T truth, but at least something that I can vouch for as, yes, these people exist in Egypt. These multiple people, these multiple women do exist in Egypt. And just in their multiple kind of in the multiple characters, the versions can come together and present a more complex vision that then can speak to the stereotype and prove it wrong or prove it simplistic.
You tackle what it means to be religious and how elastic the meaning of religion can be over the course of the novel. At one point, we learn what religion means to Rose. And there's a passage that I'd like you to read that gives us insight into Rose's take on religion. You don't mind reading that passage?
No, of course. Yes, it's a passage on page 104, if anyone has the novel. And it says, Rose, too, considered herself religious, but she suspected Gamila did not believe that. Rose still prayed 5 times a day most days. She still fasted the entire month of Ramadan. Her religiousness, though, was part of her whole, not the center of her being. And she was happy with that. It was precisely because she was religious that she refused to believe that God, the all-merciful, all-knowing God, would hang her by her feet and let every exposed inch of her skin burn in the fires of hell as punishment for her failure to wear the hijab, as the man on her sister's cassette had claimed.
Religion isn't an easy subject to write about, especially in a work of fiction. And I'm wondering what your most significant challenge was in writing about religion in this novel.
It's definitely not easy to write about, and there are multiple challenges. First one, believe it or not, it's ingrained in religion that it does instill a degree of fear in us. And when I'm writing about religion in a work of fiction that I know is going to be out there and out of my hands and people will read, that fear is multiplied because on one hand, I'm afraid of misrepresenting something. On the other hand, I'm afraid of offering an opinion that would offend other Muslims. I'm not brave enough to totally not care about the backlash. So there's this that's hanging, and it's something that I'm always struggling with and I'm trying to silence. It's kind of like a degree of inner criticism. And then there's also the difficulty of knowing that I'm presenting this to an audience who most likely knows very little about the religion because I'm writing to a Western audience. So from the point of view of craft, it gets tricky to decide how much information to include, how obvious I should be, how much I can leap out and assume people will, you know, kind of just gather or from context clues or something, or how much I can say without turning a work of fiction into either a sermon or some kind of totally unrelated thing where people are reading an explanation of a passage in the Quran for two pages, for example, because I can't do that either. So it's challenging on many levels, but it's also such an integral part of the lives of people in the Middle East. I mean, at some point, I think people, the audience, at least I'm writing to people in the West who have spoken to me about my work and so on, I don't think they realize it's not just that they're religious. It's part of the entire culture. It's part of what you breathe since you're a child. So the religion is so entangled in their daily lives, in their decisions, in everything, that it's almost impossible to write about a character in the Middle East without addressing religion. Even if you have to address that the character is not religious, it's still addressing religion. Because it's not something like in the West that we were used to it being, oh, it's a personal choice. Well, it's maybe a personal choice in Egypt, but it's a personal choice that everyone is interested in and everyone has an opinion about. So it's not, it's part of the culture to a very large degree. So that's why I feel it's important to address it, and it's very difficult not to address it, if that makes sense. I think I had to do it, and in this novel in particular, it became part of the plot as well, so it had to be there.
Right. Many of your characters aspire to be pure, to be a good, kind-hearted person with a strong moral compass. Some characters view the notion of purity through a secular lens, and others view it through a religious lens. That notion of purity means different things to different characters in your novel, and the title of your novel is A Pure Heart. Like I said, purity means different things to them, but they each have their struggles in achieving whatever purity means to them. Yeah, and I found that was something that each character kind of grapples with over the course of the novel.
I found that fascinating, and that's something I came across when I was researching ancient Egyptian life, and I found this fascinating myth of the afterlife when the person's heart would get weighed against the feather of Ma'ad, the goddess of truth and justice, and the heart had to be pure, so pure as to weigh as much as the feather, otherwise the person wouldn't be granted an afterlife, an eternity with the gods. And what fascinated me was that how old this is. This is like almost 4,000 years old, the first traces of this kind of myth that were found. And people, even back then, just needed to prove that they were pure. There was actually like an incantation or something that they would have to say, the 42 negative confessions, and they would say that they didn't do any bad things. And then at the end, they would have to say, I am pure, I am pure, I am pure. I just started thinking about that and about how much this is a representation of really how humans function, because no one wants to believe that they are not good. right? No one wants to believe that they have bad motives or selfish motives or whatever it is that they're doing. There's always a justification. There's always a justification. People tend to find a way to make whatever it is that they want to do sounds, at least to them, like the right thing. And it started kind of making me think about all the characters in this novel, about even the suicide bomber. There's a suicide bomber in the novel, and about how that can help us maybe understand a little bit how people can reach a point where they can do pretty much anything, including atrocities, if they can just talk themselves into believing that what they're doing is the right thing. And it all goes back to this idea of purity, of being a good person. Even if you look at regular people around you, if you look at families, if you look at relationships, people tend to justify whatever it is that they want to do. And I just wanted to use that. And I ended up trying to think about that when I was approaching every single character in the novel and kind of asking myself the whole time, why are they doing what they're doing? But on one hand, and on the other hand, why do they claim to be doing what they're doing?
Like you just said, you referenced the suicide bomber. I think his name is Sabir. We learn more about him over the course of the novel, and he commits that atrocity. But before committing that atrocity, you do humanize him and get into his head, and we understand why he's about to commit this crime, because he thinks it's something that is right in his own mind, right? In his own kind of warped thought process.
Yes, exactly. I love that you say it's warped thought process. It does get warped over, and I hope I can portray how it gets warped. But eventually, he believes this. He believes that he's justified in whatever he does. And not only is he justified, he's justified and he's doing a good thing. he may even be rewarded for it. And it's fascinating to think that someone can really convince themselves that something that horrendous is good. But I think if you think about it in terms of this need to be a good person that we all carry within, it makes it a little bit more possible or makes it easier to understand.
Objects play an important role in your novel. As part of Rose's profession, she catalogs artifacts. You write that she likes the idea of arranging pieces in new ways and listening to the stories they tell. Early in the novel, when Rose goes back to Egypt to visit her parents following her sister's death, she collects several of Gamila's personal items, and she takes those items back with her to New York. And it's through Gamila's personal items that Rose begins to unravel certain secrets about Gamila. But Gamila's objects, her personal items, only reveal fragments of her story. And that kind of leaves Rose at a loss. And I found this to be a really interesting parallel to Rose's profession as an archaeologist, in that the artifacts of ancient Egypt don't quite tell us the entire picture of how ancient Egyptians lived. And I'm wondering if this was something you had in mind when it comes to the use of objects in your novel, that they tell a story, but not necessarily the entire story.
Exactly. The use of objects is something I kind of stumbled upon in like the second or third revision. So it wasn't there from the very beginning. But the fascinating thing about it that I kind of learned through the process of writing is exactly what you're saying. They tell something, but they never tell the whole story. And the interesting thing about them is because they are objects, they give you an illusion of control. Right? They give Rose an illusion of control. She thinks that she has something solid. She has information that she can decipher, right? It's not filtered through her own sister who may be telling the truth or maybe lying to her or whatever. It's something that she's holding in her hand. It's a solid object. And therefore, it should be something that's offering her easier access to the truth. And what interested me was following all these logical steps that she's trying to take and all this very scientific approach to information, that it is what happens is exactly what you said, that it never reveals the entire truth. And it was just, I think what I like about that, it's one more layer in the novel that I could add toward this whole kind of overarching idea of complexity, that things are never as simple as they seem. And even something as straightforward as an object you're holding in your hand may tell me a story that you think is true, but then you find out it's only partially true, or it's limited, or it's even false.
So this podcast, as I mentioned in the intro, we've been speaking with a lot of Arab American authors. notions of home and belonging have come up a lot in our conversations. For instance, whether one feels more at home in America or in the Arab world, or whether one feels like an outsider wherever he or she goes. In your novel, you raise this compelling idea that, quote, fitting in was a matter of place, not of people. Do you mind reading a passage that alludes to this notion of fitting in?
Of course, no, I'm happy to do it. That's on 161, page 16 in the hardcover. Mm-hmm. And it's Rose talking about her experience. And it says, not talking, but it's like from her point of view. When they first arrived together in the U.S., he, Mark, had explained that fitting in was a matter of place, not of people. Trying to ease her transition, he had introduced her not only to his friends, but to New York's various nooks and corners. The spot in Brooklyn Heights where the city's silhouette looked best at night, the bench overlooking the pond at Central Park, where he often sat during his first months in New York, the Polish deli in Greenpoint that sold the best freshly baked breads, the Indian grocery stores that carried her favorite fruit, mangoes. Places, he explained, opened up to newcomers before people did. Places did not care how much you've lived here or where you were born. They welcomed you the moment you set foot in them. That, he told her, was the key to fitting in. She had to make New York her own. Because you're talking about the concept of place and being at home in a place and what I was trying to do here. I immigrated to the U.S., as you mentioned before, when I was 23, and I lived in various states and so on. My experience has been that you feel kind of like almost like floating when you go to a new place. You don't know the people, you don't know the place. It's very difficult to start knocking on doors and asking people if they want to be your friends because we're not in preschool anymore and people, you know, would not take to this very, kindly, and they may think you're a stalker. So I was having a little bit of trouble connecting to other people, and I'm a little bit shy to start with, which complicates things. But then I realized after a while and thinking back, what I did is I made myself feel a little bit at home by knowing the place a little bit more. Because when you move somewhere new, just the total unfamiliarity with the place makes the place seem hostile almost. It's strange. You don't know if it's safe here or not. You don't know where to get your groceries even. You don't know anything. And then day by day, as you get more familiar with the place, it starts to feel at home. And we do the same thing with our own homes. If you move to a new place, if you move to a dorm in college, the first thing you do is you try to make it your own. You bring your own familiar things into it. And then it feels more like your place. And then it feels more like you are at home. So I just like that concept because I felt it gives the person a little bit more agency because you're not waiting for people to welcome you. You're knowing the place first. In doing so, you make it your own in a way, and then you can deal with whether the people welcome you or don't later on, and it doesn't feel as kind of difficult when you feel at least anchored in the place that you're in, if that makes sense.
It does, right. Have you gone back to Egypt since immigrating?
I have, yes. Yes, I have. I went back only once after I immigrated, and then I stayed here for years for multiple reasons, including because my parents used to come and spend like 6 months with us here every year, so there wasn't much need to go back. But in the past 5-6 years, we were going, my family and I went every summer for a couple of weeks until 2020 happened and everybody quarantined. But before that, we were going, yes.
And up until like 2010, I mean, going back to Egypt after all those years, did you feel that you had to kind of fit back into that place?
That's actually an interesting question because I didn't go back for almost 15 years up till 2016, I think. So I went back and so much had changed, including the aftermath of the Arab Spring, but also just so much in the society itself. And, you know, things like overpopulation, you won't believe how many more people moved to a city in 15 years, especially somewhere like Alexandria or Cairo. Things like that. So my first trip back was very jarring. And it's something that happens, I think, to all immigrants. The immigration changes you, right? I wasn't the same person and I wasn't going back to the same place. Well, it was very jarring. It took some getting used to. I felt that I had to almost reintroduce myself to family members who hadn't seen me in so long, because the person who left is not the person who came back 15 years later. On that level, it was a little bit difficult. But on the other hand, this was where I was born and where I lived until I was 23. So there's a degree of ingrained familiarity there that just doesn't go away. You go back and you know the place also in a way that's just that nothing can change. Like in Alexandria, I know the smell of the sea. You know, it smells different from any other. I've been to, you know, shores, multiple oceans and stuff. It smells different. I know the streets well still. I know where my friends live. There's a degree of familiarity there that just never goes away. So it was interesting. It was a lot too. It was a little bit overwhelming, but it was good. It was good.
Right. Your novel captures the initial excitement and hope that many people had in the early stages of the Arab Spring, as well as the despair and anguish of the years preceding it. It's been 10 years, right, since the start of the revolution in Egypt. I mean, how do you feel about current political climate in Egypt today? Are you you know, distressed about the country's future? Are you hopeful? A bit of the two?
I think a bit of the two is good. A bit of the two good. I'm definitely more hopeful now than I was like 5 years ago. My impression, and again, I'm just, you know, my impression from afar, because I'm not there all the time, is that it seems that things are getting a little bit more stable, which is a good thing. It seems that things are maybe developing economically in what seems what might be a promising direction. It's very difficult to judge because there was so much corruption that went on for a very long time and so much political stagnation for a very long time. I don't know. I'm not an expert on this, so I don't know if it's even possible to repair the damage done by all of that and how it would be done, even in terms of political education. As we mentioned earlier, we're talking Egypt society got really split after the Arab Spring, and it was split by religion, but it's also, in a way, it's almost split by party lines, right? And one of the things that happened was that we started realizing that people didn't even have the language to talk about politics in a productive way, which we could argue we see even here now. So it's not like it's something, it's a very difficult thing to have political disagreements and to work together and be productive, of course. But it's even more difficult when you haven't, when the system hadn't nurtured a political atmosphere for such a long time. So I don't know. I really don't know. It looks better. That's all I can say. When I go back, it looks better. There's a lot of infrastructure things going on, a lot of new roads being built and so on. And people seem more hopeful, even if you're riding in a taxi, for example, in Egypt. And everybody chats, of course, in Egypt. So, you know, you get the driver taking you to the airport and it's an hour's ride and he tells you like his entire political opinion and views on the situation.
Unsolicited.
And people seem more hopeful. People seem more hopeful than they did like 5 years ago. So we'll see. I hope it's heading in the right direction, but I don't know.
Yeah, I hope so too. Well, thank you so much, Rajia, for joining us on the Seen Jim podcast today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure and my honor. Thank you.
And thank you to our audience out there for listening. Today's episode of the Seen Jim podcast was hosted by Hassan Abu Zainuddin. It was produced by Asma Baban, Muhammad Jafar, and Maryam Rizek. It was edited by Muhammad Jafar with support from Eric Kiska. Our theme song was composed by Isra Darwish, and our logo was created by Maysara Abdulhad. Seen Jim is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, and the Arab American National Museum. Seen Jim is funded by the University of Michigan Arts Initiative and the Ford Community Development Fund. Thank you for listening.